Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So, Guy, Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hi, Guy.
Hi, Gary. Oh, that was the first time, I think, for a long time, that you said hi first.
Is that how it works? Well, I didn't know there was an order to these things.
No, there isn't an order to these things, but I think it's being the impatient person that I am, I tend to say hi first, but hello.
We're not like Ant and Dec, are we? You don't have to stand the same way round every time.
No, no.
Or speak the same.
Although in many ways we are like Ant and Dec. anyway, so we're in Sofia today.
And
you've seen everything yesterday. You managed to see everything in a marathon of sightseeing.
Anyone who follows my Instagram knows that I'm a big sightseeing person, but I'm always jumping out and seeing whatever I can. And it's quite a beautiful city, incredible cathedral and a brilliant art gallery. Discovered some fantastic Belgian... sorry, what am I talking about? I don't even know where I am. What day is it?
Bulgaria. Remember?
Bulgarian
Uncle
artists.
Bulgaria from the Wombles.
Yes, yes. but we've been as far out as Istanbul, haven't we, in the last couple of
years?
Yeah,
we've literally, in 2 weeks, we've driven from the very tip of, like, you know, up in Scandinavia right down to Asia.
And it's been incredible to see that journey happening before our eyes and the different cultures and to be... Well, you know, to see what those audiences are like around Europe. And we really need to talk about who's on today. We've got Bernard Butler, who I'm a great admirer of as a guitar player. And I'm sure you are.
I am, yeah.
And of course, we got first introduced to him through his band Suede in the early 90s.
Yeah. And then, but he's gone on to, he's a man of many, many hats. I mean, incredible, incredible worker. And just, you know, even, I mean, he's, when he's not writing, playing, singing, producing, recording. He's lecturing.
Wow. And he's got this fantastic new album out with Jessie Buckley, the actress Jessie Buckley, which is just is about to complete, to drop any minute now. And the singles have been out and they are incredible.
No, for anyone who hasn't heard it. Absolutely. There's a couple of clips, of video clips available, you can see of them, there's a couple of songs which are just brilliant. And also that great friend of the rock on tours, the wonderful Catherine Ann Davis, is there's an album which finally came out.
Yes, The Anchoress.
Yeah.
Have you met Bernard?
I have. I did a day's recording with McCalmont and Butler.
I knew you would have done. I knew you would have done.
Well, it's inevitable. Yes, of course it is. But I don't think anything happened with it. And I was never asked back. So I don't know if maybe they thought I was shit. I don't know.
Well, I've met Bernard too. And he loves me.
Yes.
He loves me more than you. He texted me to tell me that.
I know. Was that just before the text I got saying everyone hates me?
Yes, it was. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune, for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them, and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you, guys, for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me?
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hey!
Bernard, you're an early bird.
Yeah, my wife goes out. My wife's a teacher, so she goes out to battle at 6:30. She goes out with helmet on her bike and just like she's going to war with London's brats.
But you're a teacher as well, aren't you?
Well, I did do some. Yeah, I mean, I do on and off. I did it for about 5 years, part time lecturing, and I'm still doing bits and pieces. But I can't be asked at the moment, if I'm honest. So
I did it for a while. I did BIM for a while.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Which one?
In Brighton. It was when I first moved to Brighton, and it was just a way of kind of embedding myself in the community. And it's,
yeah,
mate, it was jam. I was doing live performance.
Oh, I didn't know you did that, because that's basically what I was doing. Well, kind of roundabout, yeah, the songwriting stuff. But
could you expand the acronym, Guy, please?
BIM. It was actually started in Brighton. It was the Brighton Institute of Modern Music.
Yeah.
And yeah. So it's. It's one of those. Basically, trains people to go and teach at BIM. Yeah.
I thought we should start off talking about your album with Jesse Buckley.
Yes,
because I think it's an extraordinary piece of work. We both
agreed.
Did.
We both do. Yeah.
I mean, I just want to say a bit about her before we delve into it. I saw her. I mean, I've watched her work over the, you know, the years since she entered that competition with Andrew Lloyd Webber. About becoming Maria, and I think she lost.
I don't know that. We'll get to that.
I saw her recently in Cabaret playing Sally Bowles, and it blew my mind. I mean, when she sings Cabaret, you know, we all know the Liza Minnelli version, and it's, you know, she doesn't go close to that. What she does is she digs into the subtext irony of that song and the anger that is inside her, you know, because it's not a cabaret. And, you know, the Nazis are on their doorsteps. And she virtually screams this song. I mean, she sings it in this guttural voice that is not musical theatre at all. And yet everyone in the place was just dumbstruck with what the way her delivery was.
Yeah, I mean, what blew me away, first of all, going to Cabaret, was I went on. Jesse said, oh, come and see him in this play. Because that's what she's like. He said, oh, come and see it. And come. And I said, okay, you know, I didn't know what we were going to, really. I knew we were going to Cabaret. But me and Mrs. Butler got ready for Saturday night. We're going to see Jessie in this thing. You know, she's always great. And we rocked up, and it was the gala performance. And we were like wearing our anoraks, basically. You know, it's a rainy night. And we like...
Oh, just, so 90s.
Right? Not really. We were just like, should we go for a pint first or should we just go straight? And we had no idea what we were going to. And basically everyone's in tuxedos except for us. And we thought, oh, no. And then we got shown to our seats. And you know how it was in the round, Gary, yeah. And you know, people all around it, and we got shown to our seats, and it was that we were in the front row, like the front, right. And we just said, I just said, I don't think so. And the person said, I think so, you're sitting there. And my story is that just popping in just behind me, or in fact, two rows behind me, was that drummer out of Pink Floyd, that bloke?
was he?
I look over my shoulder because I'm looking around for the crowd. Look at the knobs who are all behind me in tuxedos, thinking, who's the twat in the front row with his jeans on?
I just had breakfast with Nick downstairs, and he said, oh, I love Jesse in Cabaret. Oh, he said that to me because I said I was about to talk to you.
Although the evening was ruined.
Yes, you just took my line away.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
I just said to my wife, all is well. The drummer's in the back row, and he's the drummer from Pink Floyd. We're gonna be fine tonight. I'm up front. Jesse's on the front. This is a band, basically.
The terrible thing about turning up to those events when you do get caught on the hop is that when you turn up and you just, everyone thinks you're making some sort of statement.
Yeah, we weren't.
Yeah.
No, but it was amazing. You're right. And Jessie, well, she's, you know, she's a phenomenal human being, and she's a good friend. And it didn't shock me. But that moment when she gets to the end of Cabaret and she lets loose with it is quite extraordinary. We don't really talk about what we do. I think I just said to her, that was brilliant. Well done. You know, but I came away and I just said to a few people that I think it's one of the best performances of anything I've ever seen, like performance of music, theatre, anything that night. I just came away thinking that is just, this is just amazing what I'm watching. And that person up there, oh, I've made this record. This is like last December when no one knew we'd made this record. And I was just thinking, it's pretty cool. We made this record with that woman up there because she's pretty good. It was a really great night. And she's pure character. And it doesn't surprise me the way she throws herself into everything. The one thing that resonates with Jessie all the time when I'm around her a lot at the moment, I used to always say to students, to young people, you're trying the advice or whatever. I just say the best people are unbelievably focused and prepped. They're on it. You can find them off their nut at 4 a.m. or doing God knows what. But when they get to the stage, the best people are so on it. They know every movement from what's going to happen when they get to the dressing room to that movement going to the stage to write what happens the moment they walk onto the stage and where they face every moment. You know, every moment they've thought it through and they're so on it. And if you can think that through, visualize all those elements, you know, that's how far you have to take it beyond technique and talent and luck and all the rest of it. And Jessie's one of those people, you know, when I'm around her at the moment, it sort of takes my breath away how far she wants to go. And it makes me, you know, you're on your toes the whole time, you know, because everyone has to raise their game.
What brought you together?
After she did the film Wild Rose, where she plays a country singer, and she had a kind of a loose record deal after that, and a guy called Paul Smanicki, a great guy who's now looking after us, who was charged with looking after, trying to find Jessie some music to make. And I think Paul just really wanted to keep Jessie making music, not just go just back to acting. And Paul, I think, was a fan of mine and put us together. And I think the thing that swung it was that Jessie, I made a record with Sam Lee, a folk artist.
Amazing.
Oh, okay. I love amazing. That record. Yeah. I didn't amazing. Know that was even you, because I fell in love with that record a while ago. And I didn't really research who produced it. And I got in touch with Sam on social media. He kindly sent me his book recently. There was the one on the Nightingale.
Nightingales, yeah.
But And an extraordinary multi-instrumentalist, but who lives in the woods sometimes and listens to, gets up and sings to the birds at 4 a.m. in the morning. Extraordinary man. Old wow. Go and listen to it if you
want. Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know.
I can literally make a list on just about two hands of all the people who've heard that record, but they're all very, as you are, very eminent and talented people. Like, it's literally, oh, wow, you know that. And so Jessie was one of them. And I didn't expect that at all, to be honest. Why would I? I didn't know her. And so when we did this kind of FaceTime chat, and she was wandering around, like, outside in it was rain. She's up a mountain, literally, walking through the mountain in the rain. And so, hi, how are you? And I'm like, all right. This isn't the easiest way of doing an intro conversation, but anyway. Yes, the first thing she said to me is that she loved the Sam Lee record. And that kind of, when she said that, it sort of, it flipped my brain into gear. I sort of understood straight away what land we were in, you know.
Yeah. It's very British, isn't it? There's a although there's an elements of Americana in this Jessie Buckley album. I mean, Sam is obviously very, very British folk music based, but there's a cinematic quality to the way you've built the production.
People always use that those words, cinematic and big and stuff. I never really think about it that way. I'm really glad people think about it that way. Of course, it's lovely. But I never really think about it that way. I sort of, sometimes people think of size in music. You know, we talk about terms like the wall of sound and things that present size and reverb. I always think we forget to think about depth. And that's where you go into the word soul, which is kind of like, oh my God, are we going to go to that word? You know, are we allowed to? And it's the depth of emotions that I always dive into. And so I always feel like I'm diving in rather than just trying to make things bigger and bigger. I always just try and find more, you know, and I'm never satisfied, you know, and sometimes it's just turning the thing up or doing things recording the same thing 100 times, you know, until I find the right delivery. It's all about the delivery for me with all these things.
Talking of which, there's one thing, there's that fantastic TV performance. I think it's The Eagle and the Dove, where you've got two sets of vocalists. You've got that, and this is actually very pertinent to where we are, Gary, because there's a group of voices on it which sound very Bulgarian.
Ah, now you're the first person to get that. Well, it wasn't
because we're in Sofia now.
Right, basically we got into listening to, I don't know how she found this thing of this bunch of Georgian blokes, so not Bulgaria but that part of Europe, I guess, sitting around a Christmas table, a big dining table. I mean, it's on YouTube. I'll find it and send it to you. And it's just about 20 blokes, gorgeous hunks with beards and the most, you know, sort of swarthy sort of blokes singing a traditional Christmas song. And I think it was in Georgia. And it's astonishing voices, like the voices are crossing over and going into harmonies that are very close. Sometimes they go into unison and sometimes they're with a sort of within a tone or something. And then they drift off again. And Jesse found this and we both got obsessed by it. And at one point we were going to try and use it and we didn't. And then we just found that we were just listening to all this, going, looking for more stuff like this. And then we were at one point thinking, who can we, in fact, I remember Googling Georgian singers in London and stuff, you know, and thinking, how can we do this? And in the end, she turned up one day and she said, oh, I'm going to do this little intro thing. And she just did it. And she just built her voice up in about half an hour. Wow. And I was just like, wow, this is you're something else. And she went into character with it, you know, like the kind of accent, the dialect,
because you do have to build this around her, don't you? It doesn't work if you sit there producing a record thinking, oh, this is a nice sound, or this is a nice sound, and making lots of music, and then suddenly she's drowning in it. When do you decide, let's get the vocal down, that's the most important part of the record, and how can we build around it?
So the way we did this is we wrote this in the summer of 2020, and when it was kind of loose lockdown, I can't even remember anymore, but it was we basically did it in my kitchen. Basically, she was doing Fargo, and it got postponed, which was just like, yes, this is the only reason this record came back, happened. And so she was stuck in London for a few months, and so she started coming around to mine. We sat in the kitchen, we did this 2 days a week, with just an acoustic guitar, no mics, no equipment at all, really. And we'd sit and write each song. And at the end of the day, once we had the song, we just recorded it on our phone. And that was it. And we left it. And we did that for like 13 weeks or something. And we had all these songs. And then she went off to do Fargo. And that was it for another few months. And then we kept on talking. And we started talking about, well, what are we going to do with this? You know, and then by the time Jesse came back, we had another lockdown and it started to become like that. But we were just still sitting on these songs with just really, really crappy recordings, you know, on the phone and the scratch, literally write the song, sing it once, go home. It was like that. So what I did is I thought, okay, so I was really cautious of us being trapped in the essence of what we did and not being able to reproduce it. So say going to Book Abbey Road with a band and then realizing that this has no connection with the spirit of what we did when we wrote the song. So what I did is I put these phone recordings onto into my computer, onto Pro Tools, and I tracked against the demo. And also, this is the only version of Jesse's voice I had. So I just started experimenting, putting music against it, playing along to it, basically. And I played along to it until I could get rid of the demo. So if you see what I mean, it would build up, until it was like it was something there and everything would snowball around it until you couldn't see what was there originally. But everything was built on the spirit and the essence of it. And the reason for that was that all the dynamics and the tempos were completely loose. There was no click tracks and no metronomes, and it had all these dynamics of us just sitting fiddling in my kitchen, basically. And I wanted to keep all of those in place. So that's how we did it. And that's it. And then Jessie, I would set Jessie up in her house with a microphone and an interface, really, really simple stuff, and would send her tracks and hope for the best.
And in the writing process, would you always come up with a guitar part first? I mean, because it's quite acoustic based. There's a like sound of the dobro on there, and it's as a. Did you always have the sort of musical essence first, and then she would sing over the top?
No, not at all. I mean, everything was done on the spot, pretty much. And it was, I mean, I didn't write any guitar parts for it initially. It was just whatever happened was the thing that happened at that moment. So, no, I didn't write anything in advance. I wanted everything to be super pure of the moment. And that's has a lot to do with how Sam's record evolved. And a lot to do with where I've evolved to, I don't know, somehow over the years, that I really like trying as much as possible to whittle things down to try and find the purest essence of something. You know, it's what I really try and look for. And with Jesse, it was the perfect opportunity to do this because it's somebody who's never made a record before, not really had much experience with studios, microphones, etc. She didn't really know who I was, which was brilliant, apart from this Sam record, which is, you know, probably my favorite record I've ever made. You know, and we had no expectations. Jessie didn't want to become a pop star or become the new Adele or something like that. She had no aspirations. All she wanted to do was create. This is her whole thing with her, is she just loves creating and in whatever way that is. We had no musical references, really. All the guitar was just played on the spot, and whatever I came up on the day when we wrote the song became the guitar part that was on the record.
Wow.
Yeah. I know I'm sort of hogging.
Hog away. It's fine.
I sort of scribbled down when I listened to the album, which you kindly sent us as well. I mean, obviously, I can hear elements of, you know, Nick Drake and Joe Boyd and Sandy Denny and Sarah McLachlan, the early Sarah McLachlan records. There's a folk thing, but there's also an Americana thing. There's a double bass on it. I just thought immediately, has he used Danny Thompson? Is this his Burt Jansch connection, the Pentangle?
I didn't use Danny Thompson, no. I've met Danny Thompson in the last 10 years, and I think might have been too much to do. I used a guy called Misha Mullavabardo, who plays on Sam's record. And he's a young guy, young, amazing, amazing musician. And I just sort of fell in love with his playing when I worked with Sam. And when I was working with Sam, I was thinking, I had my eye on, I'm going to use you again. You know, it's like that, really. The Burt thing is really important to me because I knew Burt for the last 10 years of his life and hung out with him an awful lot. And of course, know those records. It's had a big sort of musical, but also sort of personal influence over me and the way you approach music. obviously the sound of those, the Pentangle records with Danny Thompson on and obviously John Martin, et cetera, everything else he played on is amazing. Yeah. I thought it was a really cool idea to bring that element into something with Jesse's voice. Yeah. I thought that'd be a great thing to do.
The Burt Jansch thing is fascinating because also, because I mean, I hate to say it because it probably comes up a fair bit, because that's a similarity. There's quite a lot of similarities between you and Johnny Marr, really, aren't there? In terms of A as guitar, just that and that fantastic journeyman thing of wanting to do so many different things. Because you both worked with Burt Jansch, didn't you?
Crimson Moon.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah, at the same time, it was great. Yeah, no, I'm really happy with being compared to Johnny Marr. obviously, I grew up with Johnny's music and got to meet him when I was quite young, and he was really kind to me. He was just really good to me.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah,
yeah, and as you grow, I was much younger then, and obviously, as you grow older, you realise okay, and it goes back to teaching again. Just it's one of those things you make a mental note. People were good to you when you were young. You know, you had older people being kind to you. It made a big difference to me, and it's a reminder to always do that to everyone else. You know, it makes such a difference. You know, it keeps you going. And also when I was growing up, probably my first experiences in the band and stuff, I was thinking, well, am I just ripping off Johnny here? You know, am I going to get caught out? You know, and I think first hearing my first records I made, I thought, actually, I don't really sound like Johnny. And I don't have to be disappointed or, you know, think, actually, this is quite a good thing. And obviously, in the end, it's a good thing to not
it's a good, the way you want to take inspiration, isn't it, is to be inspired and influenced to create something new.
Yeah. Well, you weren't ashamed of being a rock and roll guitarist when you started, which I think with Johnny, they were so trying to find an alternative to that.
Yeah, but I just want to say to that, because I do think that's there's a sort of evolution that came out of punk, that punk we all know was pretty much just thrashing the bar chords, and that after that there was a sort of a posher approach to it. Well, we can't just keep doing that, and you've got people like the Pretenders, and you've got Andy Summers with the Police, and then. And then I think there was a look back to the Birds as well. And that's this idea of saying, well, I don't, and I know you've mentioned this before in previous interviews, Bernard, but this idea of saying, well, I don't just want to strum the chords. And that's what Johnny was. It was breaking it down into what's called arpeggios and triads and playing the notes within those
parts.
Chords.
That parts. Definitely your, yeah.
Parts.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I was pretty blessed with that era. I think what people, always talk about the 60s, the golden era of the 60s and 70s for obvious reasons. I think it was a bit sort of left behind how blessed we were with guitar players and musicians in the 80s. And that was who I grew up with I was at school in the early, mid 80s. So they were my guitar playing years, learning. My 10,000 hours were between 84 and 86, and so I think we're blessed with so many great musicians. I'm with two of them right now, and I don't forget that, and that's an amazing thing. Then you have to think of Johnny, obviously, and Roddy Frame, Will Sargent from the Bunnymen. And obviously you get the Edge as well. It's astonishing. Yeah. All those, there was so many, almost you pass over the Edge almost, because it's like, yeah, whatever. But actually it's astonishing music that he made. Guitars everywhere. People with semi-acoustic guitars on top of the Pops that I was looking at, even if they were white.
Barefoot.
And all these things. And I was really blessed with it.
I played a 355 on the Chart Number One video. It was mine. Yeah. The guitar got stolen not long after that.
Was it a Cherry Red 1961?
Get the serial number.
I don't think it had a Bigsby on it, but although I've got one now.
Those and people who made parts. Yeah, like Guy says, exactly. It wasn't just strumming along. I think that probably that reference is probably the early 90s. There was lots of those kind of indie bands who just kind of wanted to sort of drift into obscurity and were sort of quite sort of apologetic about making music. But I grew up on the music around the guys like you and the era you're around. And I think the interesting thing probably I found is that actually I borrowed all the stuff that you grew up on. And I really learned this from Johnny and Edwin and people like that who I got to know. They grew up on Bowie and T-Rex and all that stuff. I didn't grow up on that. I was too young for it, but, the Blondie and Madness and stuff were my first sort of pop intros, but I think I borrowed all that stuff that you'd absorbed.
Take us back to the house, to you getting your guitar. What was that stuff? Because it's an Irish background, isn't it?
Yeah, my parents are from Dunleary.
I love Dunleary. I wrote the Through the Barricades album in Dunleary.
I know.
How did you know that?
I did because I've got thousands of cousins in Dunleary, and I don't know. I probably would have been there. We basically used to go to Dunleary every single summer on holiday.
There's an old theatre there. We were set up in this old theatre. I remember rats running around. Not the Boomtown ones, the real ones.
Or the pedals.
Anyway, sorry, Ben.
Yeah. I remember reading this later on. I thought, oh my God, I was probably there at that time. And you just thought it was kind of a nothing sort of town. It was really, to be honest, it's boring. Because, where I grew up in North London, everyone was second generation Irish, and a few Poles. The Poles were like pillars of the community. They were really strong and intelligent and, just amazing people. Everyone else was the Irish. And so, all your friends were going to fantastic farms in Mayo and Donegal. And we were going to an estate outside Dublin. So that was a bit grim. But Dunleary is actually now, it's super gentrified and beautiful in Dunleary and all down that coast. I was there last weekend and it's a fabulous place. Yeah. But yeah, we grew up in Irish communities. Everyone was Irish, and listening to country music. My dad was, that's what you listened to in the 70s. All the Irish were into country and Western, which is kind of a loose, you know, it would go between Johnny Cash at the coolest end, but then it was like, you know, Don McLean and I don't know, Val Dunican even, or whatever, you know, and Glen Campbell and all the Glen Campbell stuff and all that kind of stuff. But it was country music, which has got that kind of sense of sadness and forlornness and heartbreak about it that Irish music often has, and a sort of a rebel spirit as well.
So just to butt in there, this is really, you could be describing why you're working with Jessie Buckley now. I mean, here's an Irish girl and you're taking all those influences you just mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, with the other thing, we went to, we used to go to get away from Dublin. We used to go to Kerry as a treat, as part of our holiday, because my parents had friends there on a place called Valentia Island, which is just near Dingle, right on the edge coast, remote island, basically. And so we used to go there all the time, and that was really fond memories. We all loved Kerry, loved it, the darkness and the clouds, the rain, but just mystical, romantic, beautiful. It's free for London kids who just, all we ever saw was, you know, smelly cars and stuff like that. It was just it was complete heaven, you know. You'd go and fishing and stuff, and there was no electricity, no TV or anything. It was just beautiful. So we have fond memories of it. So when I met Jessie and she said to me on this FaceTime, I said, where are you? And she said, I'm in Ireland. And I said, well, obviously you're in Ireland, where are you in Ireland? And she said, oh, I'm in Kerry. And I said, well, I know Kerry, and it went from there, and we kind of knew all the same places, and we spent about half an hour just doing that, the conversation of, well, we just got to know each other because we know all this stuff, and we haven't done anything yet. So we have a great bond over that, I guess. And I'm just a plastic paddy, that's for sure.
I think what Guy wants to know is when you first got your guitar,
yeah.
Who were you first trying to copy?
What was the moment when you thought, I need a guitar? I need, you know.
Well, I played a violin between the age of 7 and 14 at school. I got to grade 4. In fact, I play violin a lot on this record, really badly, on my Amazon 30 quid violin. During lockdown. But I played the violin, and my two brothers, I've got two older brothers. They bought a violin off a mate, a guitar off a mate at school that had like a battery amp next to it, a K guitar, and for 20 quid. And I remember them coming home and saying, here you go, you learn it because you can do this kind of stuff and teach us, and then fuck off.
First I was thinking, oh my God, how nice, brothers who actually went and bought you a guitar. No. But now as it unfolds.
No, that's the only reason. So I thought, well, all right, I'll give that. I'm fine with this, and I picked it up quite quickly with Bert Whedon.
That's
how I started.
Across the generations,
so so many guitar players we've had on here. Even, you know, guitar players
from Hank Marvin, fucking.
I mean, everybody.
Had the flexi disc on the front, the 7-inch flexi, and I picked that up, and then I learned some tunes, and I learned to play some simple Sunday Bloody Sunday. I remember learning quite early on, and new order stuff, basically, because it was Bernard Sumner's one note stuff.
Yeah.
The Joy Division riffs, that it were just quite one note. It's quite easy to pick up, you know, and if you could learn the riff to New Dawn Fades or something, and I play that back to my brother, and they're like, right, go away, and they just keep it. You can have it, and that's how I started to play guitar, because they just didn't want it back, and I was stuck with it, really. And like I said, we had great records coming out all the time there with guitars in it.
How old are you here? How old are you here?
14.
14.
14. Yeah.
I know you said it's later that you've discovered Ronson, but there's definitely element. I remember when I very first heard the early Suede stuff, and I just thought he's got Mick inside him. He knows how to play those riffs.
I mean, I didn't. I mean, we had Ziggy Stardust. So I shared a room with my older brother, Stephen, and he had Ziggy Stardust. And it wasn't something, we definitely played that, although it wasn't something that I played a lot, because I just didn't play old records generally. I'd buy the Smiths new song, I'd take it home and I'd learn it. And that was my mission. Get it, listen to it, learn it.
How long did it take you to learn the intro to How Soon to This Charming Man?
This Charming Man's quite tricky. That's but I've got that. Yeah, got that down. Some of the others were, yeah, there was some hardcore stuff in there. But yeah, and so I had, I mean, obviously had Ziggy Stardust, but it wasn't such a big thing at that time. And Bowie for me at that time was Let's Dance and stuff. You know, that was right. That was the David Bowie I knew and thought.
Yeah, that's the Bowie. Bowie was the Labour Party. That's his Blair years, really, isn't it?
You know? Yeah, but I loved it. I mean, but that was also, I just thought, oh, he's this pop star. You know, that's great. David Bowie's great, and so are loads of other people. You know, it wasn't really that special place that I discovered later on, obviously. Yeah, and as for, I definitely wouldn't have known Mick Ronson's name or focused on that at all.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
We have to make our way into you playing in Suede, I guess, which is... was that your first band? Or not? It can't have been your first band.
Apart from school sort of bands where you know you convince the bloke sitting behind you to play bass on a Sunday and they just did it and then didn't turn up or something. Yeah, there was a few of those kind of attempts. But apart from that, it was the first time. Yeah, I spent a long time, feels like a long time, probably wasn't at that time, but answering adverts and just getting turned down or going to some bloke's house in Turnpike Lane or something. And them just saying, go away. So I got turned down a lot. Some really unkind. I really unkind people that stick in my mind that I'm just like, I hope it never got anywhere. And then I answered an advert in the NME for it was about October in 1989, I think. Yeah. And that became Suede. Yeah, simple as that.
What was the advert? Can you remember what the advert said?
It mentions as influences the Pet Shop Boys and Lloyd Cole. And that's sort of strange. You would never put those together. I guess the Pet Shop Boys you would. I mean, I love both of them. I was a big Pet Shop Boys fan, still am.
And you just played on their last album, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, such a thrill. Yeah, I mean, I love them. They're really lovely. And
I grew up with Neil interviewing me because when he was a journalist at Smash Hits, he was my favourite journalist. I loved it. Every time I did an album would come out, I'd say, "Oh, can I speak to Neil, please?" And then, of course, he ends up in a pop group that's even bigger than mine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, well, I mean, yeah, that's made another story, playing with the Pet Shop Boys. But yeah, I had that, and I don't know what I thought about that, really. I think that was knowing Brett at the time who put the advert in, I think that was kind of a strategic, you know, way of wording, you know, that they didn't want sort of, you know, a Led Zepp devotee or something.
Didn't it say no musos?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's right. Yeah, something like
that. You're just a bloody muso.
You know what? Yeah, yeah, exactly. but I don't think I do, you know what? I just, it was, you know what the truth is? It was the only bloody advert that week, and I was just answering them all. And it was the only one that was in that week. And I was just like, yeah, I'll phone this one up, see what happens. You know, so that there it was. It wasn't really anything to do with the detail. It was just a bonus. I think that I do remember there was a bloke called Ken who came like the night before me, and he got into audition first. And I remember them saying, slagging Ken off because he was a Led Zepp muso, basically. And he said they should sound more like Led Zepp. That really sticks in my head. And his name was Ken. And Ken's such a sort of 60s name, isn't it, or something.
Who else was there? Who else was there? Who was were the other guys there? Or
Was Justin Frischman then?
Justine and Matt, of course, and yeah. Brett. Yeah, that's it. And they were just sitting in Brett's bedsit flat and playing me some of their demos, which were all very light and acoustic, and they were very into the Lilac Time at the time. They had a good Stephen Duff.
Oh my god, wow.
Yeah, Brett was so into Lilac Time, and I liked that record as well. He made a super record, Love for All.
Because I'd been working with Stephen just up till then, funnily enough, writing and producing with him.
Well, I didn't know. There you go. Yeah. It all comes around. So, and I loved that record as well. Yeah, and it was kind of nice. We had some quite nice times, and it was all a bit lightweight for quite a while, and it had to sort of get serious at a certain point, and serious in a. That became a sort of serious musically, and that meant heavier and darker, and that was sort of coincided with our lives becoming sort of heavier, and that I think everything evolved in that way. So it evolved emotionally in that way, the whole thing.
But this is why it's such a great time to form a band, isn't it? Because you're coming out of your teenage years and going into your early 20s, it's possibly one of the most difficult times that a human being goes through. The angst and the concern about who you are and your identity. And, you know, you have a few sort of key icons that you're trying to sort of be inspired by that will take you into adulthood. But everyone pulling and tugging in different directions at the same time as trying to make music together.
But also, I'd say, because it was musically, it was a very odd time. There was, everything was a bit lost, wasn't it? We were in the crossover between generations. So the 80s was gone. We didn't know what the 90s were yet, I kind of think. Apart from things like Massive Attack was the only really strong thing I remember from.
And also, because the Mancunian stuff was where it was.
Well, that was sort of wearing out, wasn't it?
Just going.
Yeah, it was all, you know.
Yeah, all of those things. Yeah, completely. I mean, I guess what was the thing? The 80s were very tribal between pop and rock and what you'd call the alternative. And things were very cut and dry where you were. Mm-hmm. At school at that time, you were in camps very clearly.
Certainly.
There was no crossovers. And that was about your hair and your clothes and your...
Twas ever thus. So,
everything, yeah. I mean, well, it's not now.
But I'm talking about like back to Gary in my day, certainly.
Sure, yeah. And that has had an up and a down to it, which had... it didn't have diversity connected to it, but it had conflict in there, but it also made things very, very strong and strong choices you made. And I think the thing that occurred to I don't know if it occurred to us. I mean, it's definitely what we wanted to do. I just didn't like a lot of the indie music, you know, that early 90s. I didn't really like. Loved all the Manchester stuff. I loved all the baggy stuff, the indie dance stuff. I loved all of that. That was such a brilliant movement, and that was a great time for me to be at that age and being stupid and going out and stuff like that at that age. But coming out the other side of that. I just think we just didn't like a lot of the music around. We saw music that was incredibly successful, what was in the charts, and there was a huge void between, you know, Phil Collins or Annie Lennox or something like that, all those things that were hugely successful and where the flip side, alternative music, there was no real strong identity. And it wasn't like, oh, let's design a band to fill that void. There was no concept in that way. It's just that I think we liked making music that had strong melody and a strong sense of structure, and people could sing. It was really simple. Like, we didn't want to make music that people didn't want to like. We thought, this is the music we listen to, and this is what we're trying to do. So let's try and do something that people connect with.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely it plugged into the stuff that I grew up on, obviously. I mean, I was blown away by your first album. You know, I thought it was the most incredible record I'd heard since the early 70s, you know, seriously. I mean, I just thought the combination of you and Brett made was something that had emotion. It had English subtext of suburbia and storytelling and angst. And it was all there in between your guitar and his voice. And the kind of songs you were making, but I think also
there's lots of character, you know, character, and what he did. You know, that Suede songs aren't very coverable for one reason, just that then they're very hard for anyone else to sing those words. But it's a distinct, very distinct thing, a distinct character to the way he sang at that time. He kind of adopted a kind of tone and a delivery, which he was good at, and people, as soon as people responded to it, he just did it more. And a way of writing, a thing that he explored with his writing, lyrics, which people responded to, and he got more into it, and we all did that. I did that, and I fed him with music.
I was going to say, how was the writing working?
I mean, I just wrote, I didn't write any lyrics for Suede. It was all about music. And very rare. I've never really done this since, but just gave him pieces of music fully formed and pretty much, and often together. Often,
like Johnny, the Smiths.
Yeah, very like that, yeah. And often sitting together and massaging them together and working them out and stuff, you know. But things were became more and more blunt. And our lives, I think, even though, like you said, Gary, you expect that part of your life to be fun and just sort of a bit of a giggle, you know, and I don't remember it like that, really. Like, there were times like that, but it was so, I found it really fraught and really very sink or swim, our lives at the time, wondering what would happen to us. And I think both of us tried to make music that was very like that. It was standing on the edge of the cliff. That's always the sort of idea that I always have in my head, the image of you have to jump or you have to make this work. And so musically I did things that were a little bit like when you play a piano very bluntly, and you, as a bass player and a guitar player I've got here in front of me, the bass player, you comes down on the left and the right comes down on the two, you know how you do that. Bam, 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 like that, just big 1-2 steps, everything very blunt. So rather than strumming an acoustic guitar very nicely and very gently, everything would be like bam, 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 you know, and I wanted everything to be like that. So it'd be like, you will get this, you know, listen to this. And if you don't like it, that's fine, but you won't miss it. That's the approach. And so it became a sort of a rhythmic thing of how he approached, very
you know, people get very cross, don't they, with bands if they fall apart, and because they're making the music that is important to them, and sometimes it's fantastic music, but to live with someone in a band that you're not comfortable with, and I've been there, is hellish, and people outside feel you somehow need to stay there because you owe it to them, because you've changed their lives with that music.
Yeah, it's awkward, isn't it? I mean, listen, the way you do feel like you're playing a public service, but then again, that sounds a bit arrogant because you're very grateful for doing it and being in that position in the first place. So, you know, it blows me away to hear even you say this now, after all these years, that you're listening to that record. It still never, never ceased to amaze me. But I just feel that the whole thing is about growing and reinventing and challenging. All the people I like did that. And so it surprises me that people want me to do the same thing when the whole point is about changing and learning.
You're absolutely right. But especially with the music that influenced you, that was the whole point, wasn't it? Was that you were going to hear something new every time. You're absolutely right.
I was listening to your last week's show with Ken Scott, which I could just sit after 30 seconds and write something down. You know, it's one of the ones where, like, hold on, what did you say? But one of the great thing, one of the many great things he said was about how when he finished a record with Bowie, they didn't listen to it and didn't talk about it, and they just moved on. And for me, that's always the way I think about things. If you say that to people who love your records, they can't understand that, because that's the point of it. You make a record so you can listen to it over and over, don't you? And from our side of the fence, if you're sitting around listening to a record and wanting to do the same thing, then there's something wrong. So I really, it really resonates with me, people who have that mentality, and I'm really grateful for that. It's so good that I'm not still in that band. It's such a fucking brilliant stroke of luck for me. But after 30 years, because I just think of everything I've done, I just think of Jesse, for example, it wouldn't have happened. Mm-mm. It's just there's so much that wouldn't have happened. And I'm so grateful that I had that when I was young. And it was at some points it was a brilliant laugh, and at some point it was hell on earth. But I don't really mind that. I'm really happy to think that was part of my life, you know, the good and the bad. And then I went and did all this other stuff.
Listen, I don't want to dwell on Suede too long, because there's so much about you that's more than this. But I do just want to...
Because it's two albums. It's two albums in your life. No matter how important... I mean, yes, they're incredibly important, but you've made so much great... Exactly, there's just so much.
But I think Dogman Star, and I know there was massive issues for you during that making of that record, and it got very mixed press, and, you know... Some people called it the most pretentious album ever made. I think there's some incredible work on that, Bernard. And Asphalt World, I think is an extraordinary piece of music which stands up and has stood the test of time. And it's definitely, I can hear inspirations of, and I'm going to use that word we often use on this program, prog. Just really trying to push the boundaries. You're saying, we're not going to do an album that is like the last one. I want to experiment more and look further with music.
Someone said to me at the time of around that first record, someone at the label or something said to me, you know, you want to do what T-Rex did. And I didn't really care about T-Rex that time. I mean, as I said, it wasn't something I grew up on. That you want to do what T-Rex did and just stick to the template. Get that template. That's what he did. That works, do it again and again and again. And it was a bit like somebody had stopped me and my blood went cold. I really remember that time thinking, uh-oh, no, I can't, I'm not going to do that. I'm just not that person. So, yeah. And I also felt like, well, if T-Rex did that, well, they've already happened and they were really good. So there's really no point in just doing that all over again.
Yeah, but they were two albums, really. That was, you know, Mark started tailing off after that.
Well, because he stuck to the template, or he tried to, and but that really, and so I remember that I wanted to tear things up, and I think it's just a mad thing, really, because it's seen like if you tear things up artistically that you're some kind of nasty saboteur and you're trying to destroy career suicide and you're trying to mess people's lives up or something. And I was seen a little bit like that at the time, but I just thought I was doing my job. You know, I look at you lot, all the things you do and you're doing now and everything. And this is what interests me. People you're in Sofia today playing with Nick Mason or God knows, and lots of people, and look at all the people we all play with. Mm-hmm. That's the point of me. That's the point. You do something and then do something else and it keeps getting exciting. And if we get to this point in our lives and we're still doing this silly thing that we all learned to do when we were 14 because we heard a good record, it's like, wow, what a life. It's what a life. You know, I still think that. What a life. You know,
but there's elements of Asphalt World, though, that I can hear in your music now, where you're experimenting with guitars and different and textures. And this was the direction you were going in.
I was having fun and things changed. I wanted the drums to sound like Martin Hannett. That was the thing. I wanted it to sound like, I loved Joy Division. I grew up with Joy Division, the Martin Hannett sounds. And I wanted the drum sounds, the panned drum sounds and echo and stuff of Martin Hannett and the guitar sounds. I don't know what I'd been listening to at that time. It was Bits of Floyd, actually, in a way. I'm not like, I've never gone into a massive Floyd sort of times in my life, but I remember there was certain things at that time which I listened to a lot. I think it was Medal, and I think that because that's the one with the long instrumental stuff going on, isn't it? And just stuff where
echoes, echoes. Well, I always thought, you know, just one point I'll make about that, the Hannett George, it's because every night when we do set the controls for the Heart of the Sun, and I've always thought that is the greatest song that Joy Division never wrote. It's like you could stick that song in the middle of Unknown Pleasures and you wouldn't notice. It would fit right in.
I mean, it's the feeling of sound, isn't it?
Yeah.
And getting absorbed by the sound. I was also really obsessed with that time with You've Lost That Loving Feeling by the Righteous Brothers, which is still like a favourite record ever. And there's just something about it.
Yeah. Not Human just, League did a cover of that as well, didn't they?
Not just as a pop, not as obviously a great, great song, great pop song, but I just got drawn into this sort of dark oddness of his voice and the sound of it and the opening line, which I always adore, and all the things that happened.
I can hear a lot of Scott Walker in your work.
And Scott, of course, and Walker Brothers. So that's the kind of stuff I was absorbing at that time, and also not. There was a record by Mark and the Mambas, Mark Harmon's side project, Torment and Toreros. And he made this very strange, dark record about 84, I think. It was always one of my favourite records, still is. It's played a big role in the Jesse record, actually, as well. And that was a big, big influence for me at that time. Because it reminded me of when I was growing up, and it had been a very dark teenage record to listen to, and it was like the flip side to anything, I guess pop, you know. And so those are the kind of influences I had when it came to guitar playing. I was just learning, you know. It was just learning. It's like, oh, suddenly I've got a guitar and I can do this, and I had a four track, and I'd record something and then overdub it. You know those days, and you know where everything is absolutely new.
Yeah.
And I was just layering stuff up. And but for me, it wasn't really the parts. It was all about the delivery, the emotional delivery. My dad had just died, and that played a big role in the way I was feeling. I was, you know, in a rock and roll band, and my dad died, and while I was on tour in America, and I went home to the funeral, and then went back on tour a week later. And then spent 6 weeks in America with people just having a party, and that is the biggest impact on my life, probably that moment, you know, of everything. So kind of, because you were kind of told to come on, get on with it, you know, and I think that took me probably a good decade to recover from that moment. Not in a bad way. Again, this is stuff that happens to everyone, and it's part of my experience. But if I'm talking about how music evolved at that time, it's got a lot more to do with that than listening to sort of Pentangle or something. Actually, you know, just that emotional sense of where you are, you know, and how you evolve, and then from that coming out the other side, you just say, right, gonna go. I'm going to do something else.
What you do is you go off and talk to someone dear to my heart. You you team up with David McCalmont, my son's David. Godfather.
Is he? Oh, my God. I bet he takes that super serious.
Well, he's really chosen serious. Very carefully. Stan already had a Godfather. He was chosen as a sort of cultural, only because David is so, apart from his incredible music, he's so beautifully versed in film and Shakespeare, and we thought it'd be a great cultural resource for Stanley, which of course he's not using at all. But I did actually tell David that I was talking to you, and he said, I'm struck by how much of a down-to-earth regular family guy dad he is. I don't want to make him sound ordinary, but he is, in exception to many musicians I've worked with, treats his compositions and playing like a trade, which it underscores the genius beautifully.
Oh, God bless Dave. Yeah. He doesn't like me calling him Dave.
How did it happen? Because it's, you know, if I was writing you, if you were a fictional character, I don't think I would have had you leaving Suede and meeting up and making those kind of records. I think that took everyone by surprise that you went in that direction.
A classic single. I mean, it's amazing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know. I was having fun. You know, like I said, I think, again, you're in that band and that's all the music you listen to and all you ever want to make. That's the kind of the view from the outside, isn't it? But we know that's not true, because otherwise you lot wouldn't have done the million things you've done, you know. So it's, you're not just stuck in that one place. What you're listening to, going away listening to, is, I don't know, Billy Joel or something like that, because you know, I want to party like everyone else does, and you know, an ABBA and all those things, and I guess leaving Sway. So when you leave a group, when you fall out of the group, all those things, your whole life disintegrates in terms of the backdrop of your friends and all that kind of stuff. Because when you,
but that's also the scariest it's ever going to be. I remember the first time I did that was when I left this Australian band Ice House, and it's so scary because it's the first time you've ever known any sort of job or, you know, money, anything.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, and you build, when you're young, you build your life around that. You just end up absorbed by it. You're doing everything, socializing, hanging out, and then when it's gone, it's suddenly like, oh, I don't actually know anyone. You know, it was really like that, and so we had to really quickly. Quickly try and find some sort of enjoyment, you know, try and pick myself off the ground, really. And had this piece of music, which was just literally trying to make some fun, beautiful, uplifting music, just trying to cheer myself up. I wanted to do something with strings. I wanted to do something that wasn't around guitars necessarily. There was this record by Swing Out Sister, which I really loved, called You On My Mind. It's about 1989. Oh, okay. And I really, really loved it. It's like a Bacharach kind of sweeping, pastiche, but really beautiful, really lovely record. And it had all these Bacharach and David key changes going on and stuff. And I always in my mind wanted to do something like that, something that felt like that, had that kind of swooping cinematic feel, as you say, you know. I was listening to Dusty an awful lot.
That comes out with you a lot, by the way. Dusty over the years with various people. Yeah.
Well, obviously McDuffie as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, had this piece of music, and actually David, it didn't go to first. It went to, there was a couple of other people. It went to Kirsty McColl was one of them.
Ah.
I found Kirsty's house and Morrissey.
In Ealing.
Yeah, in Ealing. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And Morrissey was the first one, and he got played it, and he really wanted to do it. And then he said, oh, I can't do it. So I was like, okay, fair enough. And then Kurt,
did it have lyrics, or how were you presenting the melody?
So this is a complete instrumental with drums, strings, structure, the whole thing. No melody, no lyric, and it was just a piece of music. And I think people around me thought, oh, this is a good tune, you know, somebody's got to do this. So then I found myself in Kirsty's house in Ealing on a Sunday afternoon, and guess who, the doorbell goes, and it's Morrissey standing there, and it's like, it's really weird now. And then we, the three of us, are in her garden. I was like, I don't know if she knows that he got this. I don't know if he knows. And I'm just this twat who's just like just left a band, and I'm just like, I want to go. And I remember going home, and I shit you not about this. Honestly, this is kind of the stuff you make up, and it's not. I got home, and there was an answer. You know, we had answering machines in those days. Press play, and it's, hi Bernard, this is Johnny Marr, got your number? And I was like, oh. Fuck. And I swear to God, I was in the middle of the three of them, and I just thought, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know. I know you lot all know each other, but what is going on here, you know? And then, man, it was very strange. So anyway, they didn't end up with any of them. And
the stars were aligning.
I don't know. It's just I got ended up in a strange sort of, I don't know how that ended up. Anyway, I met David. I was asked, I'd met him once before, and I went to see David at the Jazz Cafe, and David did his set, his solo set at the time. But what stuck in my mind, apart from him being amazing, was he had a drummer, a Japanese guy came on and played the drums. And Jazz Cafe, you know how it's got that big ceiling and everything's pretty loud in there. Mako, this guy called Mako, was playing the drums, and I just looked at him and I just thought, oh my God, well, I want David, obviously, but I want you, whoever you are, I want. You know, so I really zoned in on him.
What's his name? Sakamoto?
Mako Sakamoto. So I remember, I met David after the show and gave him a tape, and he came around to my house 2 days later, and he bashed out one verse, and then a couple of days later he came back and he sang the same verse twice, which no one ever notices on that song. It's only got, he just repeats the
verse. It's worked for Noel. It's worked for Noel for years.
But what a voice. What a voice. Yeah. And, you know, we had David Arnold on the show, because David's worked with David as well. In fact, David did strings, I think, on one of the albums.
Yeah, on the second one.
Yeah, he's been really great to me over the years, David. I love that song. I mean, the principle was that
it became an anthem for the Irish marriage vote, didn't it?
It did. Yeah, me and David went over there
because it's called Yes. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we didn't actually know about this. We got there just when the referendum was just happening, and we had no idea that they were using it. It's one of the very many beautiful aspects to that song that happened. It's so great for me, but obviously so great for David. You know, as a gay man to go to Ireland and that be happening, what a great thing to people to sing your anthem, you know, about freedom. So, the principle was that I wanted it to be like a Northern Soul track, that no one knew who it was, there was no picture on the cover, it was a disco sleeve, you know, the whole, and it didn't matter about looking at me swinging my hair around or whatever, and or what we looked like or any of those things. It wasn't a band, there was no t-shirt, there was no tour, there was no poster. It was literally going back to that my sort of obsession with the pure essence of music. And if I look at speakers like I'm looking at now, and I always look at the cone, you know, the cone on your speaker, and you see the way it goes down like a cone, and you see this moment of infinity in the middle. And I always think that's where the sound comes from. And you have to find that sound, the most pure essence of music. And so how far can you get into that, where you take away everything but just the sound that comes out? And that's the way I wanted Yes to be presented. There was no album, there was no nothing. It was just a piece of noise that you'd just turn on, dance to, and just forget about everything else. And it was hard work. It became really hard work because people didn't like it at first. The label didn't like it. David's label weren't interested in it. They wanted David to be a big star and in a solo way. And, you know, I didn't really have a label. People weren't, we sat on it for a long time, for about 6 months before it came out. And eventually it came out and it did its job on its own. It just sort of, it just happened, you know, that song, and it still does. Yeah, I love it.
So when you said, but was there an album plan? So was it just the song and then the album happened, or?
Yeah, it was just that song. And there was another song called You Do, which was the idea was that it would be, they're in the same key and one's fast and one's slow, and they'd be a double A side. That was the principle at first. And then we eventually thought, okay, well, we'll do two singles, make it like that. And the label got on board and said, well, can you do more songs? And we were like, well, we haven't got any. And so we did things really quickly. And so we went into Rack on a Sunday afternoon, with like some real bare bones of some new tunes. And so basically the story is, I'd booked an engineer and I was going to produce, which of course I didn't know how to do, but I was like, well, I'll just do it. And the engineer didn't turn up. And there was this guy there who was the tape op, as we used to call him in those days. Yeah. He was standing there and he was going, well, I can do it, mate, I can do it. And I'm like, well, look, we paid for this engineer and he'll be here in a minute, I think. And it got to like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're all waiting there to record. And I said, OK, look, you're going to have to do it or we're not going to do anything. So this bloke who's pestered me all day, his name was Nigel. And so Nigel did it. And then the engineer turned up and we said, mate, you're fired. Because my new mate Nigel's doing it, and actually it sounds pretty good. And so me and Nigel, and that was Nigel Godrich.
Oh my God, yeah. Wow. He went on to produce Radiohead, obviously.
Yeah. So yes, me and Nigel became mates at that time because Nigel was just like, just the pestering engineer who just thought, I can do this, why are you getting someone else?
That's how it happens, isn't it? You know,
it is.
I did a day with McCummer. I can't remember what it was in Rack. I don't think anything happened with it, did it?
It didn't come out, that was with Mike Hedges.
That's right.
And that was when, I was met Nigel at that time, but before that I met Mike, and I was really blessed with what happened with Mike. He had a big influence on me because when I came out of Suede, we were using studios, a big mixing desk, and I was told, stay back, Sonny. You want to stay out of this, you know. And of course, all that makes you want to do when you're young is say, well, actually, I want to know more now. I want to know what's going on. And I want to know how this is done. And I want to listen to podcasts with Ken Scott revealing everything. why weren't they around in those days? So I went to Mike's studio in France and he had the old EMI TG wraparound desk, which is, I think, The Dark Side of the Moon was mixed on this. Mike was just very experienced. He'd done it all, seen it all, made lots of money, had his chateau, and he'd say, there you go. I said, how did this work, Mike? And he said, oh, you did it. And I was like, right, okay. And the EMI desks were very simple. You literally had a fader, and on each channel you'd have bass and treble, basically, some presence, I think it was called. And that was it. Not much to it. So you could just do things and move things around on the desk quite easily without breaking anything. And Mike would just sit at the back and said, give that a go, go on. And he'd sit at the back and have a cup of tea and a sandwich and just encourage me to do stuff. And it really, really sticks in my head that he did that for me, because it was somebody a bit older than me who had the confidence to say, why don't you try something? You know, you'll make mistakes, but you're going to find out how this works. And that's how we made Yes together, me and Mike, by doing that. Just me just turning things up and distorting stuff and just making mistakes, and him just laughing.
So that distortion, that distortion has elements of Phil Spector, doesn't it, about it as well? Because that's the kind of wall of sound that we recognize. I want to ask you, because obviously that album was going to come out as McCalmont and Butler. On the album you did with Jesse and the one you did with Catherine Ann Davis, the anchoress, who's been on.
Oh, so yeah, great friend of the Rock Conteurs. We love Catherine. Yeah, we love her.
And you chose. Okay, let's talk about the Jesse album briefly again. So you that's not a Jesse solo album. That's you and her as the artist. How did you approach that? Did it not seem at first to you that this was going to be a Jesse album?
And it was, yeah.
How did you say, you know what, I'd really like my name on it? And how did it also work with Catherine, etc.?
Well, with Catherine, it's a different thing, because it's done over a period of about 12 years, and it sat there for about 5 years. And
it's a brilliant album.
It's fabulous, fabulous, yeah.
And we've done it over different stages, and we hadn't actually met that many times. We'd written, and I'd worked on it in between, and I just went to her and I said, you know what, I'm going to mix this and finish this off. Are you game? Should we just put this out? Because otherwise it's going to sit there forever. And that was literally how that came about a couple of years ago. With Jesse, and I stuck my name on it because I think to distinguish it from what Catherine was doing, the Anchoress, that project. Jesse, I mean, yeah, I fully thought that, oh, this is gonna be Jesse's record, and she said she wanted me to be on it, and I think that's partly just, you know, she just wanted a partner, you know, didn't want to be on her own with it. We made it together anyway. Listen. I think they're all my records.
but I think that was
I'm producing, I'm writing, or whatever. And it sounds like, I don't mean that in terms of ownership. Oh, it's my record. I mean that in that I dive myself in. If I like something, I dive into it emotionally in exactly the same way and lose myself.
Yeah. And was it just after that experience with Mike Hedges, you were just like, yeah, I produce, I can produce.
But I met great people like Nigel. You know, Nigel was my age and a young, brilliant engineer. He had a BBC trained dad. And so he was a sonic obsessive, Nigel, you know, me and him became mates, and so we did stuff together, and it was a good laugh, you know, and grew up together in that way for a few years, doing loads of stuff at RAC, and then when he went off with Radiohead, you know, and the rest is history with him.
Yeah. Finish off on what you were saying, and I completely get this, that you're going to, this album is Jesse Buckley and Bernard Butler. This is a story. This album is a story of you two artists coming together. It wasn't a solo album, but at other times you have worked with artists who are so diverse and outside of what you do. And when you approach someone like Duffy, say, how were you?
Tricky.
Or Tricky, exactly, which is another brilliant album, by the way. How do you say, this isn't really part of what I normally do, and I'm going to try and find what belongs to you as an artist?
I don't try and... You've got to try and find the other person. I never try and find me in it. I always try and find other facets. And so Duffy, the story is, I heard a demo with an acoustic guitar and her voice is in one very nice mid-range. And so I just said, well, what's not here? It's always the crack in the door. I always think, where's the crack in the door? You know, like when you see these cartoons, you're like, you'd see a crack in the door, what's there? You know, and I always think about in that way, what's here that we're not seeing? And with her, I could see it was really obvious. Acoustic strum guitar, a voice sits in the mid-range. I just wanted to hear low and I wanted to hear high. I wanted to hear a range, and it was simple. And when we did that song Rock Ferry, which is the first time, it was the day we met, it was as simple as that. We wrote a song with no chorus that has three stages where it goes between this range and it goes steps up a little bit, and then it goes to the octave for the third verse. And it's as simple as that. It was trying to find something that she wasn't already. And that kind of opened the door, that doing that song, for what happened afterwards with her and with other people as well as me. So I always think about, it's about finding, all these people. I just try and find, who are you? You know, I just want to find, who are you? And that starts with just talking to people. Jesse is brilliant with it because, you know, we just sat in my kitchen and talked and talked for a long time before all the songs. And we talked about what we'd read, what we'd seen last night on the telly, what films, what, you know, this quote you saw, this painting. I wrote everything down, and she did as well. And then we just sat down with a guitar in Dadgad. Actually, most of this album is in Dadgad or Open D, which is a total, the first time I've ever done this. And so everything was very much a drone. So I could drone everything and just read out the words and the things that we'd written down. And we just assembled them, like, you know, the old Burroughs cut up technique thing.
Yeah.
Taking strips and saying, what does this mean? What does this mean next to this? And what does this line mean next to this one? And okay, now we have something, and this is interesting, and talking about it. And all the time we're finding out about ourselves and hopefully pulling something out of human beings that everyone's got it. And it goes back to teaching again. I'd always say to, look, I know all you've ever heard is Ed Sheeran, but I know you're a human being and there's so much beyond you. There's so much you're thinking about and doing, and there's so much going to happen in your life. Getting to that, it's getting to there underneath that is where things become interesting, you know, and that's where great songs are, I think.
You said, I listened to an interview with you recently when you had talked about at times when you'll be writing with lots of different people. And you're just you're deeply involved in several lives. It's always, and you kind of have to, the psychology of each episode of each person you're going to see.
I've been with my wife for 30, I don't know, over 30 years or something, and so I think these are all my affairs, my mistresses, all these sort of partners, and that's the way I look at it. It's really nice to dive into people's lives for a week, a day, a year, and then that's it. You create something and then you dive off and we do something. I think that's a really nice quality that you can do that with strangers, you know?
Is it harder doing something like the Libertines, where you've got a band that everyone loves live and, you know, and there isn't much room for you to sort of emboss yourself upon them?
Well, when I met them, they hadn't really done anything. So I did the first single and then I did one after that, Don't Look Back Into the Sun. And by the time they got to that point, they had become a bit of a phenomenon. But at the first time I met them, they were still playing to like 20 people. So it wasn't hard, you know, and the brief really was to try and bring out make an interesting record, not just make a punk record, basically. And again, I didn't want to just take a punk band and make them sound like The Clash. I just didn't want to do that. And that's where I lost with them, really, because, of course, Mick Jones...
I was going to say, then they get Mick Jones, so...
Yeah.
God bless him.
And what's interesting is it's you stick his voice completely dry up the front. You don't make that Clash record, do you?
Yeah. I didn't want to do that. I thought that... So when the Libertines demos, before anyone had heard them, there was two voices on them, and they'd put them through amps, and it sounded a little bit like The Strokes. But I said, I remember at the time Jeff Travis played it to me at Rough Trade, and I said, who's the singer? And he said, well, there's two. And I was like, well, they sound the same. I couldn't distinguish them. So it was really important to try and make them distinct. And they were very distinct voices, Pete and Carl, but at the time they just sounded the same. So I didn't want to sound like they were just a shouty sort of, well, Sham 69 or something, you know, that was the danger, you know.
I know we mentioned him earlier, Bert Jansch, and your love for him. And we all know he's such an incredible guitar player.
and you know, the Travis picking on acoustic guitar that he's known for, and all of the his brilliance. How do you then decide, oh, I'm going to go and play on his record? And what was it like sitting in the room with him and thinking, what am I going to play that's going to be anywhere close to what he does?
I mean, I became mates with Bert first, so that it was kind of easier than that, because you were just there. And if you were in Bert's front room, you were playing with him. That's because he didn't really talk much. So that's all that happened, really. And in terms of playing with him, I noticed one thing about him really quickly. He doesn't play electric. And at all. I think he had one electric guitar in the house and that was it. And he didn't play it. And I just thought, you don't do this. And, you know, when you try and play that style, the style that, you know, kind of, I always think of it like that. You'd really grab
the claw.
It doesn't sound very good in an electric guitar. He had a Tele, you know, it just didn't sound very good in a Telecaster. So I just thought, well, I'm going to do the thing that you don't know how to do. And also, it's quite easy to do sort of bluesy stuff. The problem was that Bert was very used to playing on his own. And so he didn't respect time signature, tempo, anything. You know, he could drop a beat anywhere he fancied and he'd turn the cycle around and you were lost. And so it was hard. Yeah, hard work. But again, come on, you've got to be good here. You know, I wish I could do it now, you know, with him still. Wow. You know, I miss him a lot in that sense. But he was really, again, he was another one of those older people who was just really kind to me and just made me feel like, yeah, you can do something and let's just go and play some music together. And I'm really grateful for that relationship.
Because aren't you part of some association I don't know, his legacy foundation or something, yeah.
Yeah, there's a foundation, the Bert Janssen Foundation, yeah. And which I'm a part of, and we meet up a couple of times a year and try and encourage things to happen. We put some funding into one of my local schools recently, actually, to do a guitar trip and things like that. We've had a thing with sending a guitar around as a journey called 80 Plays, sending it around people and getting people to play and be influenced by Bert. So yeah, he had the song that really sticks in my head is It Don't Bother Me, which whenever I think of Bert, I just think of that, mm-hmm. It Don't Bother Me. And that was everything with him. You know, people often talk about Bert could have been a superstar and, you know, he could have been, you know, and the influence he had on Jimmy Page, yeah. Famously, and all those things. And whenever you got close to Bert, he was just, don't bother me. He just wanted to sit.
What tuning did he use? Was he dadgad man?
No, almost always regular. That's the other thing. Wow. You know, you think you go into it thinking it's going to be extraordinary folk tune, Joni style tunings. Mm. And most of the time it wasn't. He was just sort of where he put his hand, I was just like, well, that's not an E major to me. I don't know where that is, you know. And yeah, he was quite extraordinary, but he was a happy soul. You know, he had a really, really great life and he was happy with it, doing his thing quietly, you know, and that was a huge inspiration because, again, it goes back to that pure essence where it was about just the sound you make. So it's a good influence in life.
You've just been working with an old friend of mine, Claire Grogan, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You're doing the new Altered Images album.
Yeah, I have. Well, I've done two songs with Claire, yeah. Claire's my, she lives on the corner of our road. Claire and Steve.
Claire and Steve. Oh, yeah. I used to work with Steve quite a lot.
Yeah, they're lovely. I've known them for years, just because they've lived here as long as me.
So are you producing that, or are you just writing with Claire on some of them?
I've written and produced two songs with Claire and Steve. Yeah,
I've written with Steve as well. Lovely man.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And yeah, they're good friends. And Claire wanted to do Altered Images again. And she's great. I love her. She's a spirit and she's a character.
Fantastic.
She's got character in the way she sings, the way she is as a human being. You know her longer than me, obviously. And
well, we know, of course, she was the muse for a certain song. For a certain song.
We're not going there.
Yeah. Well, you started this, so yeah.
Yeah. I'm just thrilled you making that record. And that Bobby Bluebell is on there. Because Bluebell is someone with the Bluebells who's someone who's always been around in that sort of postcard, orange juicy kind of scene of Scotland.
A massive pop writer.
Yeah. Bobby's, we did a co-write with me, Steve, Claire and Bobby in my front room. Yeah.
How did it work?
It was just funny. He'd like, Steve was getting some beats and Bobby was just going, I was at the piano and Bobby was just going through my record saying, make it sound more like T-Rex. And I'm like, oh God, Bobby.
But how could you do that? Because I worked in a whole TV series with him in the 90s, and I don't think I ever understood a single word he said.
Yeah, I get involved with a lot of Scottish people. I don't really know why.
Roots.
I don't know why it is. I'm doing a thing at the moment with Norman Blake from Teenage Fan Club and James Grant from Love and Money as well. And we're doing like a trio thing in September where we play each other's songs. And we did this at Celtic Connections as well. And everybody up there has been in, they've all been in Orange Juice or Altered Images, every one of them. Everyone knows each other.
Because you worked with Edwin as well, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I knew Edwin and worked for Edwin and lots of Scottish bands. And I don't know why.
I love that scene. I found myself gravitating to it in about 1981. And you know, I just made this album, the second Spandau album with Chart Number One on it. And there's some sort of strange kind of proggy music on the second side. I don't really know which direction I was going in. And I started hanging out with Altered Images up in Scotland and I was always in the car with them being driven around from place to place, Socky Hall Street. And the album that always used to go on was Marvin Gaye. And that was being played, you know, Let's Go, you know, Al Green, or, you know, that's what they were into. They were into their soul, those Scottish kids.
Listen to Marvin all night long.
And I wrote the true album, really, because of being driven around Socky Hall Street by those, that lot.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, so we're North Londoners. How do we end up in Glasgow? Mixed up with all these people.
Well, I have an Irish grandfather, and I think that's, and you're the, you know, you obviously have your Irish roots. I think we connect with that Celtic passion.
Yeah. Well, I think it's soul as well. It's interesting. The Scots from that. Yeah, you're right. They all seem to. They're all really into their soul and country. Again, it's something about the Celtic connection with country music, I think, and soul music. I think that's what it is. Just like with the Jesse project.
Bernard, you're just about to break the record of, I think, of the longest rock on tours, it's frustrating that we have to leave you.
There's so much stuff we haven't touched on. Ben Watt, there's...
I have to say, I'm really blown away by you two with the record you made, that you've got me here and you know my music. I still find it astonishing. I sit in this room on my own most of my life making music. And when anybody outside of it hears it, it still blows me away. And the fact that you two are talking to me, asking me about this, it's really great. And it's a really nice thing. I always say that collaboration is the key to everything. You know, being around great people is where you absorb everything. And that's how you have to keep learning. If you shut that down, you'll never learn. And so it's a real joy to do this. I could do all the same with you two, for sure.
This album deserves to win all the awards. I think absolutely. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Oh, thanks so much.
What a man.
What a love, and so genuine and enthusiastic. I love he's got a fantastic natural big picture view of, that's why, obviously why he finds producing easy.
I think he's a decent human being, and I think that's really the crux of it all. I think he works with people brilliantly because he's such an open, an easy person to be with, who's very musical. Yeah.
Unlike us.
So I recommend the National Art Gallery here.
Yeah, that's where I'm going. I'm going to go and rent a little lime scooter and buzz up there.
Downstairs is a local artist from the turn of the century, and he's known as the Master, and that's really worth looking at. But there's loads of great stuff.
That's great information for me. For our listeners, perhaps not so much.
No, not so much. No, we're really sorry. Because we can't get him on the show. He died a long time ago.
Listen, keep the comments coming. Keep listening. Thanks to Ben. Thanks to everyone. But thanks to all of you for listening. It's such a joy to keep this going. It's, the feedback's great. And the fact that the people on the show listen to the show is what we love as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's good night from me.
And good night from everyone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.